All right, chapter 3, Hitler's war against reason. Statism and the advocacy of reason are philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist, neither in a philosophic system nor in a nation. If men uphold reason, they will be led, ultimately, to conclude that men should deal with one another as free agents, settling their disputes by an appeal to the mind, that is, by a process of voluntary, rational persuasion. If men reject reason, they will be led, ultimately, to conclude the opposite, that men have no way to deal with one another at all, no way except physical force, wielded by an elite endowed with an allegedly superior mystic means of cognition. See the birds like that? I tell you, that's pretty much what it sounds like is going on to us. A physical force wielded by an elite endowed with an allegedly superior mystic means of cognition. All right, the branch of philosophy that deals with the powers of reason as a cognitive instrument is epistemology, and this issue is the key to its relationship to politics. It is not an accident that Plato, Kant, Hegel, Marx, and the whole tradition of German nationalism from Luther on advocated a variety of anti-senses, anti-logic, anti-intellectual doctrines. The statism all these figures upheld or fostered is a result. The root lies in their view of knowledge, that is, of man's mind. The aspiring dictator may not be able to identify in philosophic terms the clash between reason and his particular schemes, but he too is aware of it. In some form, he knows that he cannot demand unthinking obedience from men or gain their consent to the permanent rule of brutality unless he has first persuaded his future subjects to ditch their brains and their independent, self-assertive judgment. He knows that he can succeed only with a populace conditioned to seek neither evidence nor argument, a populace which, having shrugged aside the demands of logic, will agree with and then endure anything. Hence the spectacle of status of every variety and throughout history, both before and during their period in power, systematically attacking the mind. In some terms, these men have grasped that their political goals cannot be achieved until the proper epistemological base is established. Hitler grasped it too. In one sense, it is incongruous to speak of a Nazi epistemology. The leading Nazis were not philosophers. They presented no systematic theory of knowledge and were ignorant of most of the specific issues in the field. Nevertheless, there is a Nazi epistemology, in the sense of an unequivocal, consistent, and passionately urged position on the subject's fundamental issue. "We are now at the end of the age of reason," Hitler declared to Hermann Röschning. "The intellect has grown autocratic and has become a disease of life. The life of a race and of a people is a mystical synthesis," writes Rosenberg, "a manifestation of the soul which cannot be explained by the logic of reason nor by causal analysis. Even the most profound, the most learned of intellects touches the surface of things only," writes Gottfried Nietzsche, a young Nazi intellectual. Now we go to a block quote that is taken from Röschning's book, The Voice of Destruction. It came out in 1940. And this is what he writes. "Everything of which we are conscious, all that is thinkable and understandable, is but thin snow on the high mountains of the unconscious, snow that will quickly melt under the storms of fate, of some intoxication, of the trembling of the soul. Life would rather hide its ultimate secrets in a small folk song heard in the village night than in fat and scholarly books. It is vain to try to plumb the depths. We will never, by ourselves, be able to learn the essential. All we can do is be moved by it." What should men appeal to for guidance once the intellect has been rejected? "We must distrust the intelligence and the conscience," states Hitler, "and must place our trust in our instincts." "Trust your instincts, your feelings, or whatever you like to call them," says Hitler. The last clause indicates the latitude permitted to the Nazis on this question. They were free to advocate, and did advocate privately and publicly, every non-rational source of alleged knowledge that men have ever invented, including revelation, intuition, trances, magic, and astrology. And in parentheses, the latter was a special favorite of Goebbels. What they could not advocate and were urged not to practice was a single cognitive method, the one Hitler grasped to be incompatible with Nazism. And the quote from Hitler, "At a mass meeting, thought is eliminated. And because this is the state of mind I require, because it secures to me the best sounding board for my speeches, I order everyone to attend the meetings, where they become part of the mass, whether they like it or not, intellectuals and bourgeois as well as workers. I mingle the people, I speak to them only as the mass." The masses are like an animal that obeys its instincts. They do not reach conclusions by reasoning. Reason is the faculty that identifies, in conceptual terms, the material provided by man's senses. Irrationalism is the doctrine that reason is not a valid means of knowledge or a proper guide to action. Mysticism is the doctrine that man has a non-sensory, non-rational means of knowledge. Irrationalism and mysticism together constitute the essence of the Nazi epistemology. The politics of Nazism, with its racist obsessions, its anti-Semitic demonology, its gesticulating furor transmitting directives from Providence, and its all-obliterating appeal to the power of brute force, is unprecedented in the West, not for its collectivism, but for its undisguised irrationality. The brazenness of this revelation is matched and made possible only by the brazenness of the Nazi epistemology. Its distinctive feature is self-proclaimed barbarianism, that is, undisguised, boastfully trumpeted defiance of reason. In the Nazis' leadership's view, Rauschning, a one-time friend of Hitler, reports, quote, "The more inconsistent and irrational is their doctrine, the better. Everything that might have gone to the making up of a systematic, logically conceived doctrine is dismissed as a trifle with sovereign contempt." To all doubts and questions, says Rosenberg, the new man of the First German Empire has only one answer: "Nevertheless, I will." "When I hear the word culture," said Hans Jost, president of the Reich Theater Chamber, "in an immortal line, I slip back the safety catch of my revolver." "People set us down as enemies of the intelligence," declared Hitler. "We are. But in a much deeper sense than these conceited dolts of bourgeois scientists ever dreamed of. The enmity extends across the board, to the central forms and expressions of human reason, from its first groping appearance in the life of the young child to its major existential product in the modern world, the Industrial Revolution. The former is to be defeated by teaching children to despise their brains, the latter by teaching the country to return to nature. Childhood education, Hitler holds, must concentrate on the breeding of absolutely healthy bodies and on the development of instincts or character, that is, the particular emotions the Nazis wish to inculcate, while systematically downgrading any intellectual element and de-emphasizing the process of cognition. We don't intend to educate our children into becoming miniature scholars, said Hans Schemm, a leading Nazi educator. The real values resting in the German child are not awakened by stuffing a great mass of knowledge into him. Therefore, I say, let us have rather 10 pounds less knowledge and 10 calories more character. In one of his utterances, Hitler leaves no doubt about the nature of such character. A violently active, dominating, intrepid, brutal youth. That is what I am after. I will have no intellectual training. Knowledge is ruin to my young men. So is the product of knowledge. Nazi literature heaps abuse on wealth, cities, machinery, and Germans' preoccupation, in Hitler's words, with an industrialization as boundless as it was harmful. The credo of modern society, writes a Nazi, Werner Sombart, in a bitter denunciation, is, quote, more motors, more currency, more goods, more rapid production, more rapid travel, livelier enjoyment, prosperity, progress, without end, without end. And that quote comes from Mein Kampf. The antonym of such progress is indicated by the second part of the Nazi slogan, blood and soil. Soil in this context means the life of the humble, unthinking peasant, or of state-run, racially pure agricultural communes, as well as the life of the cunning, mongrelized city dweller. It means the selfless martial discipline of Germany's Middle Ages, as against the modern desire for economic comfort and well-being. It means a mystical merging with primitive nature, as against an atmosphere of insatiable profit-seeking production and cold, calculating mechanization. Most Nazis concerned with the need for armaments do not urge the dismantling of industry. What they do demand is its subservience to the right kind of men, the ones whose allegiance is not to science or business but to instinct and raw nature. Such subservience, in the words of one observer, is what takes the sting out of industrialism for the Nazis. The sting, at root, is the fact that modern industry is a product of man's mind. In summoning the Germans so openly to a life of muscles and mindlessness, Hitler was counting on a widespread anti-reason attitude, an attitude that no political party by itself could have created or sustained. In the field of epistemology, the Nazis were merely repeating and cashing in on the slogans of a 19th century intellectual movement, one which pervaded every country of Europe, but which had its center and greatest influence in Germany. This movement, the defiant rejection of the Enlightenment spirit, is called Romanticism. And as a footnote, it says, the term Romanticism is also used in aesthetics to designate an art school opposed to classicism and later to naturalism. This usage must be firmly distinguished from the broad philosophic sense of the term explained in the text. Progressively abandoning their Aristotelian heritage, the philosophers of the Enlightenment had reached the state of formal bankruptcy in the skepticism of David Hume. Hume claimed that neither the senses nor reason can yield reliable knowledge. He concluded that man is a helpless creature caught in an unintelligible universe. Meanwhile, a variety of lesser figures, such as Rousseau, the admirer of the noble savage, were foreshadowing the era to come. They were suggesting that reason had had its chance, but it failed, and that something else, something opposite, holds the key to reality and the future. The two figures who created the new era and made this viewpoint the norm in the West, the two who welded the mystic stirrings of the late 18th century into a powerful, self-conscious, intellectually respectable voice, and who placed the voice at the base of all latter philosophy, were Kant and Hegel. Kant is the father of the Romanticist movement. It is he who claimed to have proved for the first time that existence is in principle unknowable to man's mind. Thereafter, Hegel, Kant's chief heir, most powerfully articulated the new movement's central ideas in every branch of philosophy. But neither Kant nor Hegel is a full Romanticist. Kant opened the door to the movement, but hesitated to walk firmly through. Hegel did walk through, but paid vigorous lip service to reason all the way. There were many, however, who did not hesitate and who did little to mask their views. In Germany, the most influential of these men were J.G. Herder, another hero of the Nazis, and also Fichte, Friedrich Schlegel, Schelling, and Schleiermacher, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. Just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? The product of this main Romanticist line was an army of lesser intellectuals and fellow travelers, generally cruder and more open than their mentors, who helped to spread the new approach to every corner of Germany. The Romanticists held, following Kant, that reason is a faculty restricted to a surface world of appearance and incapable of penetrating the true reality. Man's true source of knowledge, they declared, drawing explicitly the conclusion Kant had implied, is feeling, or passion, or intuition, or faith, etc. Man, in this view, is not a rational being. He's, in his essence, an emotional being, and he must seek the truth and live his life accordingly. Although most of the Romanticists advocated some form of religion, religion is not an essential component of this philosophy. On the whole, the Romanticists were more modern than that. They offered a somewhat secularized version of the earlier religious approach, stressing instinct more than revelation, the voice of the subconscious more than of the supernatural. But they never forgot their philosophic ancestors and brothers in spirit. While condemning the civilization of the Enlightenment, they passionately admired two cultures, the medieval and the oriental. Hostile to the cold objectivity of the scientific method, the Romanticists turned to avowedly subjective fantasies, priding themselves on their absorption in an inner world of intense feeling. Scornful of the shallowness of Aristotelian logic, they flaunted the fact that the universe they constructed, the universes they constructed, were brimming with depth, that is, with contradictions, A's endlessly blending into non-A's, and vice versa. Contemptuous of the static world of the Enlightenment thinkers, a world of stable, enduring entities, the Romanticists denied the very existence of entities. Their dynamic universe was a resurrection of the ancient history of Heraclitus. Reality is a stream of change without entities or of an action without anything that acts. It is a wild, chaotic flux which the orderly Enlightenment mind cannot grasp. Opposed most of all to analysis, to the dissection of reality performed by man's conceptual faculty, to the distinctions made by man's intellect, the Romanticists praised wholes, so-called organic wholes. That's W-H-O-L-E-S. The source of this particular notion is Kant's Critique of Judgment. The whole, they declared, is not the sum of its parts. It's a thing which consumes and transcends its constituents, obliterating their separate identities in the process. The master organic whole, these men commonly held, is reality itself, variously called the absolute, God, etc. Typically, it was construed as a kind of cosmic craving, an all-encompassing impulse or process of striving called simply the will. This theory developed from Kant's idea that demands of the will are the key to the universe. The advocates of such a view are known as voluntarists because of their claim that the will is essentially of reality and that the physical world is merely will's superficial manifestation. Voluntarism is a frontal assault on reason. The theory implies that reality as such, and man too as part of it, is inherently irrational and even insane. In Schopenhauer's version, for instance, the world will is described as blind, insatiable, and absolutely senseless. As a result, its offshoot, the world of appearances in which we live, is a nightmare universe condemning man to ceaseless agony. The only escape, Schopenhauer says, is a denial of one's will to live, followed by the oblivion of nirvana. In Nietzsche's version, what rules man, and he suggests reality, is an equally blind and senseless will, the will to power, which is, Nietzsche says, not to be denied, but exultantly affirmed. To affirm it, he holds, one must reject the mind and act instead on the spontaneous drunken outpourings of the orgiastic Dionysian, that Dionysian element in man, or raw passion. Why? You ask why, declares Zarathustra, in a remark that encapsulates the Romanticism in Nietzsche and the unreason in Romanticism. I am not one of those whom one may ask about their why. The philosopher's flight into a world of will, or of the past, or of the East, did not prevent their followers, especially in the latter part of the 19th century, from applying the Romanticist viewpoint to the issues and concerns of life on Earth. An education, stressing the intellect, such men charge, places too great a burden on the child and thwarts his emotional development. An education teaching facts and objectivity improperly emphasizes external factors at the expense of the child's inner experience. What Germany needs, they concluded, is a new kind of institution, not cold, cognition-centered learning schools, but feeling-centered Lebensschulen, or life schools. Now think about what's going on in education here. Sorry for the parenthetical remarks here, and what they're trying to stress now. And that's what, if you ever check out Bloom's taxonomy, that's exactly what's being promoted. I mean, that's what promotes what we're reading about here. Saying it again. An education stressing the intellect, such men charge, places too great a burden on the child and thwarts his emotional development. Really. An education teaching facts and objectivity improperly emphasizes external factors at the expense of the child's inner experience. Basically, don't think. Just feel. All right, I'm finishing up what I read. I'm repeating it. What Germany needs, they concluded, is a new kind of institution. Not cold, cognition-centered learning schools, but feeling-centered Lebensschulen, life schools. Encouraged by liberal progressives and conservative nationalists alike, the Romanticist education proceeded gradually to supply this need, first in the Empire, then in the Republic. Thus, the schools were ready for the Nazi educators when their time came. Modern science and its product, the Industrial Revolution, the advocates of Romanticism charged, thwart the emotional development of everyone, whether child or adult. Individualism, they said, is atomistic. Capitalism is materialistic. Urban life is artificial. Factories are ugly. Labor-saving machinery is soulless and a source of misery. By contrast, medieval peasants, in one commentator's words, quote, were supposed to have been happy, natural, uncitified, and uncultured, literally in contact with the earth, supposedly most beneficial tie. I will destroy the present order of things which wastes man's powers in the service of dead matter, concluded Wagner. Like Hegel and generally under his influence, the Romanticist is concerned with politics characteristically found an organic social whole to exalt. Germany. Selfless service to the Volk, the people, most of them said, is the essence of virtue. Such service, they usually added, requires obedience to a dictator soon to appear in Germany, a hero who can divine the will of the Volk and mercilessly smash any nation or group, such as the Jews, that stands in its way. A well-known German historian has remarked that the Romanticist element in German thought would appear to Western eyes as, quote, a queer mixture of mysticism and brutality. That's the end of the quote. The formulation errs only in the adjective queer. The mixture's two ingredients have a magnetic affinity for each other. The first makes possible and leads to the second, and not only in Germany. By the time of the Weimar Republic, Germany's intellectuals, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews alike, had reached a philosophical consensus. If we are to solve our country's problems, they said to one another and to the public, we must follow the right approach to knowledge. the right approach as they conceived it was eloquently described by Walther Rathenau, who was not a fulminating nationalist or racist, but an admired liberal commentator, a practical man, government minister, diplomat, industrialist, and a Jew. The following block quote I'll be reading from was taken from Modern Germany by Koppel S. Pinson. And this is the quote. The most profound error of the social thought of our day is found in the belief that one can demand of scientific knowledge impulses to will and ideal goals. Understanding will never be able to tell us what to believe, what to hope for, what to live for, and what to offer up sacrifices for. Instinct and feeling, illumination and intuitive vision, these are the things that lead us into the realm of forces that determine the meaning of our existence. And that's the end of the block quote. Rathenau and his colleagues did not know the full nature of the realm of forces into which they were delivering the country. They did not know who ruled that kind of realm. They did not foresee the consequences of the instinct and feeling they were begging for. They found out. In 1922, the instinct and feeling confronted Rathenau in practical reality. He was assassinated by a gang of anti-Semitic nationalists. A decade later, the same fate befell the Weimar Republic.